Does anybody have any questions or comments or contributions at this point? Would somebody hum for a second so I can make sure the connection's still there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I had muted the phone, so sometimes I have to go reach back and unmute it again.
Yeah. And I appreciate that because you can imagine I'm here all by myself talking like crazy. And then an electronic glitch could have turned the phone off. So thank you for that. It's helpful.
And Jen?
Yes.
The last part of what you said really resonated with me, and I was trying to write here like crazy, but I don't think I got everything. When you were talking about the fact that making restitution, it's a creative process because you can't go back to the point before you harmed somebody or you harmed yourself. Can you go over that again?
Okay. Yeah. I remember at one point in my life, I said something destructive. Now, fill in the blank. I don't need to tell you. All of us have said something at some point that hurt someone in a way where not only were they hurt, but it showed something about me. It's as if there are some places in life where you rip the fabric. Now, you can replace that fabric. You can sew it, you can seam it, you can use the magic glue from the television commercials, you can do a lot of things, you can reweave it. But it's being torn. And consciously, you and perhaps another person knows it. So even if magic happened, and that energy were dissipated, and the fabric were put back together, so that there was no physical evidence whatsoever that that ever happened, it did happen. And what I'm describing is, I'm not sure if I'm describing it or whether I'm recommending. So let me play. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this. Let me play for a bit. What I'm trying to express is that in restitution, if we are simply trying to replace the fabric so that there is an illusion that the tear never happened, there's a falseness to that. That it is more honest to live with a patch, to live with a darning, to see the repair work, to know that something happened and that something was done to address it, rather than erase the evidence by completely eliminating the effect. That's what I'm referring to here. So, going back to what I started to say, I said something that hurt someone. And I was in my 30s, and I had an epiphany. I had a moment where my eyes got big and I said, wow. Because I didn't think that at any point prior to that, I had ever felt that I had said something that was damaging, that could never be retracted again. And I got this visceral sense that I had created a wound that would heal, that there would always be a scar there. And in working with that, what I've learned to do is to respect the scar and appreciate it, rather than try to erase it or ignore it, to appreciate the fact that a scar is part of life, that that scar was caused by me, that I am capable of scarring people, and that it serves as a monument, as a reminder, not to how bad I am, but to remind me what can happen if I'm selfish or careless. So where I was going in the previous example and here is that in restitution, if you're trying to cover it up and make it go away, that's not restitution. And trying to pretend that it never happened by replacing all the evidence is not restitution. Restitution is about addressing what happened, dealing with the damage, and doing what you can under the circumstances, and accepting the fact that some things will never be completely whole again. It's a little bit like Humpty Dumpty. Things don't go back together again, and to pretend they do is false. It can be a collusion. People cannot want to know how selfish we are, and so they would love to pretend that that never happened. Does that really serve you on a spiritual level? Does it serve them? Whereas if we give restitution, let's use this example, where you have said something very harmful and damaging, just plain cruel. The most you may be able to do is to admit to that person that you recognize what you did. You may be able to recognize how badly hurt they were. But giving them $100 to go see a therapist is not restitution. Sending them flowers is not restitution. Does that answer what you were asking about?
Yes, it does. But then, what do you do with it then? Like, you know, like, do you stop at the point that you just realize that you are capable of wounding and what happens when you are careless? But the reality is that now there is a wound that healed and there's a scar.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? Like, where do you go from there? What do you create from it?
And at that point, it would depend on the actual situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I can give you suggestions, but if you simply think, I think that anybody over the age of 30 has hurt someone.
Yes, yes.
It may not be fun to remember that moment, but it's there. So if you reflect back on a moment where you hurt or insulted someone, what can be done? And what I'm saying is that one of the most healing things you can do for someone is to admit it. Now, you don't have to grovel. That doesn't necessarily make somebody else feel good, that you're groveling. In fact, that's an example of where you create false guilt to hide the real guilt, where you may exaggerate or over-dramatize the situation until what they say is stop. Stop with the apologies. But that doesn't mean that you have fully addressed the situation. It just means they don't want to hear about all your stuff. And they don't want to handle all your emotions and all your guilt. So they say, stop, stop, enough. And if you take that and say, ah, I have made restitution. No, you haven't. Okay? Restitution for a casual, cruel statement could go on for years. If you tell a girlfriend that she's fat, that may be true, but that's not the point. That her ego could be so fragile that to hear that from someone she trusted, just it's the last straw. It just leans on a fragile ego structure, and she collapses. And she goes into a lot of wounding with that. What that may mean is that for years afterwards, whenever the opportunity presents itself for you to support her, you need to do that. That's restitution. That's keeping the fact that you did something cruel and thoughtless alive. And saying, I not only never want to do that again, I want to take positive action so that I'm in a different space. So not doing something is one thing, not repeating the action. That's one part of it. But being willing and able to enact a more positive way of being for yourself and hopefully for others. So in other words, restitution, this is a, I don't want to say standard, but it's a common story where if someone is drunk and they kill someone with their vehicle, you can't get that person back. And the family may not want to talk to you. They just may not be able to deal with that. What they say is, leave us alone. Okay. At some point, you may do that because trying to get involved with their grief is not helping them. That's what they're saying, and at some point, you may need to accept that. But what I mean by a common thread is you could take that opportunity to move your life in a different direction where you help 10,000 people. And you may never get the chance to go back to that family and say, I know I caused you harm. It was grievous harm. I will never be able to make you whole. But what I want you to know is I took my energy, my life force, my lovingness, and I released it out into the universe. And I have done everything I know how to make safe, loving environments for other people. So the death of your loved one didn't go to waste. It changed my life, and I did, etc. It's just drawing a picture of restitution without necessarily camping out outside someone's door and pleading, please forgive me, I'm so sorry. That restitution is about why you did it, what's going on with you, and perhaps what that incident was given to you for. So I want to introduce a little bit more here. The guide says there are no accidents and no coincidences. And what that means is that if you harmed someone, that was not a blip. That was not a, oh, well, every once in a while it happens, get over it, apologize, and go on. If there are no accidents and no coincidences, what was going on there? Restitution may be about truly looking at the gift of the feelings that have come up about this. So, for instance, if you've done something that society condemns you for, but you don't think you're guilty, restitution may be about trying to find out what the grain of truth is in that. Restitution may be about coming and humbling yourself to the place where you don't agree, but apparently it causes other people a lot of harm, and you are going to respect their reality and give a little bit on your opinions and your values. That's what I mean about creative. Instead of saying, I'm sorry, and I'm going to write you a check, and I'm very confident that this check can be seen as restitution for what I have done. It might, and it might not. And our job as spiritual beings is to see the truth as deeply as we are able to see it. It does not make you wrong for not doing restitution. But this work is about the fact that 20 years later, you may realize that you were wrong on something. And at the time, you denied it, and life went on. But if 20 years later, you realize you were wrong, what are you going to do about it? That person's long gone. They don't care. They're not your friend. You can't contact them. Even internet searches won't find that person. What do you do? The realization is a gift. It came to you 20 years later because you weren't ready for it when it happened. But 20 years later, with the development of your being and the development of your integrity and your perception, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, now you're ready to see it. So the memory just floats to the surface one day, and you go, oh, my God, what was I thinking? Energetically and spiritually, restitution can be done. But you may not be able to go back to the original incident or the original parties concerned. So you will need to be creative. How are you going to take that understanding and knowledge and put a positive spin on it and bring it more forward into the world? I'm kind of long-winded, but I was still trying to address the question about restitution and creativity. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Jan.
Yes. Are there any other questions? Or sharing?
No, but I'm still listening.
I generally only need that once a session, Harry. Thank you. So the game is that maybe we're done. Okay? There are some lectures that are, it's not that they're simple, right? I've never found one that's, let me use the word simplistic. I have never found a lecture that's simplistic. But I have found lectures that are, that there's a flatness to them. There's a, this is it, and you knew this was it, and it's pretty obvious. Now, go out there and do something about it. So that's where sometimes when we're presented with a spiritual principle, we're not in protest about it. And yet, protest is one of the signals that we're out of integrity. Now, I'm not talking about protesting an action that you think is wrong. Okay? I'm talking about a but that comes bubbling out of you when you read these things. So when people say, well, I don't understand this, and I'm not sure about the integrity part, and I don't really think that I'm doing too much terribly wrong, and I don't have a lot of examples, that's why I have come to rely upon the one-page document that's called, the title is PC10, it's on the website, and it's in this package of materials. And the path workers who worked with the guy as part of the first training class got together, and they actually delivered the lecture on spiritual law. If you look at the small print, it was not delivered by the guide, it was delivered by the class. And I find that interesting that the guide didn't really go into law that strongly. And then they made this one-page digest, which has 9 principles of spiritual law. And what I have found is a teaching mechanism, and I invite you to consider this in privacy, in your own space, that you can look at this document and go down it and read the principles, and on a joke level, because it's faster than spiritual language for me sometimes, on a joke level, find out which one you say, oh, no, I get all the others, but not that one, okay? Find the law where you say, I don't understand that. That makes no sense to me. Find the law where you immediately come up with a number of items that don't fit that law or that situation. That's the level of protest that the guide talks about. That's gold. That's fabulous. When you protest against something in this sense, you are certainly not willing to accept it, but it's gold because you haven't gone numb. Okay? So submitting or going numb or simply not getting activated by something is not necessarily goodness, not necessarily an appropriate response, and it doesn't necessarily help you. One of the best things that will help you is seeing your own protest, seeing your activation, seeing your but. Okay, so if you go down these titles, and what they've done is very cute. They've given you a quickie, and then they gave some a couple of quotations from lectures to attempt to illustrate it. Now, they're not all as clear as perhaps they ought to be, but it's enough to get you started. So I'm going to give a quick example, I hope. But what we've been talking about is the law of cause and effect in this lecture. So basically what the lecture says is the cause of guilt is a fundamental unwillingness to love. That's the cause. And then you've got all these effects. Okay? Sometimes we know what the cause is. Even if we're unwilling to deal with it, we know what the cause is. But sometimes we only have the effects. And if, when we see the effects, we don't take the time to study and work at and go after what could these be about, then it's a natural certainty that we won't find the cause. So the law of cause and effect, and the quote says, every act has its consequences. It is more difficult to see the same relationship between thoughts and subtle attitudes. The more developed person can perceive cause and effect on these less obvious levels. So all the law of cause and effect is saying is that if there's effect, there must be cause. If the effect is wonderful, then maybe you don't want to take the time to find out the cause, although it would be useful, because if you found that cause, you might be able to replicate it and make more good stuff. So these rules, these suggestions, work just as well for the positive parts of our life as the negative parts. The reason why we focus on negativity in spiritual work, at least Pathwork does, is because that's where you may find yourself unable to see, where you may have done such a great job of hiding the cause that your conscious mind cannot penetrate. And that's where working with other people, working with literature, whatever spiritual practice you choose to use, this is where exercises, guided meditation, affirmation, there's a lot of material out there to help you. And if you say, I'm a wonderful child of God, and you go, yay, and you just go off in the world and manifest yourself, congratulations. Obviously, there was nothing holding you back but a little push, and you gave yourself a little push, hallelujah, you're off and running. However, if you say to yourself 20 times a day, I am wonderful and a child of God, and still sit like a lump, saying, well, kind of like a child of God, but not good enough, you haven't addressed what you need to address. There's more there. So let me circle around to some things I got out of the Leonard Cohen concert. I watched him, and I realized that he was being completely himself. And I think that's one of the reasons why people respond so strongly and spontaneously to him. There's a lack of artifice, a willingness to put himself out and just be with it. And what I looked at was, Jan, where are you not willing to put yourself out because you have judgments on yourself? So by watching a positive example of someone, I realize that I'm not quite that free, and I'm not quite that willing, and I don't believe that I'm that good. Well, where did that come from? So I took it back, and I said, how can you be more open? And as just as a for instance, one of the ways you can be more open is just to assume that you will be received by the other person. How many of you have walked into a room defended because I'm pretty sure they're going to pick on me for my clothes or my hair or my speech pattern or my idea? That's being in a defended state. What if you walked in the room and said, imperfect as I am, I want to be here. I want to be with you. I'm going to find as much as I can that will contribute. And if I find something that doesn't contribute or hold you back, I will work on it. I may not be able to get rid of it, but I will try to minimize it without repressing it, without pretending it's bad, but I will just notice. I will notice feedback. Now, sometimes the answer is wrong crowd of people. Okay? These guys don't like you. Your values don't work for them. They never did, and that's why you feel so stifled. Well, if that's the answer, go find a group of people that will welcome you so that your life force will flow. Now, if you're stifled, because you're trying to pretend to be somebody else, which you will never be able to do. Get over it. Try something different. You don't have to rip your mask off overnight. You do not have to walk emotionally and psychically naked into a room. That's an all-or-nothing kind of mentality. And to some extent, it's a game because it's designed to fail. Very few of us can transform overnight on every single level of our being. We may get an epiphany that shows us a whole new reality, but the next day we're just trying to brush our teeth in a different manner. That's as much as we can handle of this great big epiphany. So any place where you feel that your life force is not moving, start looking at why. You might be in the wrong place with the wrong people. There may be truth. So change and let yourself out. And if they throw you out of the room, they can be doing you a favor. I remember once, we all have our worst nightmare scenarios. And my worst nightmare was that if I did not, and this is literal, I don't sing along. I'm notorious. I'm infamous for the fact that I will not sing along. Once every 2 or 3 years, I will sing with a group of people. It's a long story, and it doesn't matter. I don't sing along. So when people are singing, I'm always aware that they glance at me wondering what's wrong. And my worst nightmare was that somebody would say, if you don't sing, you should leave. So I was in a group of people in a class, sitting on the floor, and they start singing, oh, my God, Kumbaya. Oh, my God, you know, a cliche. And I'm not going to sing Kumbaya. I'm just not going to do it. And I'm sitting next to this woman who happened to be Dutch, so she had an interesting accent. And she turned to me and she said those words, if you're not going to sing, you should leave. And the miracle was that I started to laugh. Because even though that was my worst nightmare, I wasn't a kid anymore. I was a grown woman. And some classmate sitting next to me making nasty remarks that had no authority over whether I was part of the class. And the class was not being graded on sing-along. It was just something they did for the last 5 minutes of the class. And I don't know who she thought she was, that she could dictate my life to me and dictate what the... It was so outrageously crazy that it was like it was a pain, of glass, and my worst nightmare was a plate glass window that got shattered that day. Woman did me a favor. I have never had that fear again. You turn to me and say, if you don't do it, you ought to leave, and I'm going to laugh at you. Okay? What I'm talking about here is my life force does not flow in sing-along. Now, maybe there's an issue there, but until I feel that there's some negativity, I'm just going to keep my life force moving in a different direction. Okay? If that was a problem, then I would need to address it. If I was surrounded by situations that required sing-alongs, I know I'm going on a bit about this, but there we go. If I'm surrounded by a life situation that is crammed full of sing-alongs, so that there seems to be no escape, then that's an invitation by spirit for me to address it. And I think I ought to. But if once in a blue moon something comes along that I don't wish to participate in, that does not necessarily mean that I am an unloving person. It does not necessarily mean that I should change my personality. That by being polite and considerate of others and not stopping them from doing what gives them pleasure, I'm being responsible and loving and kind. And my nightmare was that just holding space for other people wasn't enough. It was useful to get over that. Now, I honestly don't know what that story has to do with this lecture. So, you know, please forgive. I thought it had something to do with it, and I went on and did it, but there you go.
Well, I like the story anyway. But I wanted to ask you, you mentioned in your conference details about Emmanuel's statements,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know where to find that you mentioned, those 12-step programs.
Okay.
On that. Could you give me a hint about where I could find that?
Yes. On my website, under audio, there are the study materials for every single teleconference. So this teleconference is listed as Restitution for Real Guilt. And if you click on that, it downloads a PDF file that's 5 pages long.
Okay.
Part of that 5 pages is the PC-10 Spiritual Principles and the 12 Steps and a 2-page digest of 109. And why am I saying 5 pages? It must just be 4. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
And you can always Google 12 Steps. They're rather popular. So you won't have a problem downloading 12 Steps. In terms of Emmanuel's work, I was privileged to attend a couple of workshops with Emmanuel, and so I got interested, and I read Emmanuel's book. And I find his message remarkable, and I've integrated it into my spiritual practice. So I speak of it a lot out of tremendous affection. The fact that Emmanuel and the guide seem to know each other, the fact that both the hosts or the medium for these two spirits were pathwork helpers, and as much as I love and respect the guide, sometimes it's really nice to hear the gentleness of Emmanuel, because the guide can be very confrontive, and it's useful, and that's what I was trying to describe about the work. There's a place where we need to be confrontive, because our defenses are very strong and active. And if we aren't confronted, then it's easy to dodge and just go along in distortion. So sometimes it's very, very useful to undergo, I remember either in 108 or 109, there was a phrase, basically, pain is necessary. Pain will get your attention. Pain will tell you something's wrong. And that's what I'm describing in terms of finding the places to work. The easiest way to find places to work is to keep a diary, daily review. I keep singing that song about daily review, daily review. You keep track of the moments during the day when you got your feelings hurt or you felt pain or, totally up to you what you're focusing on. And a good place to work is what that series of moments means from a slightly distant perspective. What I'm suggesting is that there are patterns. Some things hurt you and some things don't. So you've all experienced this. You can be at a dinner with a bunch of people, and people can be saying tiresome things, they can be rude, they can be callous, they can say all kinds of things that you could take personally. You may not take most of that personally, and then one person will say one thing that really zings you. That's yours. The rest of it may not have anything to do at the moment with your personal process. I want to be real clear about that. It's not that it's not important. Negativity in any form is always important. But working someplace where you don't feel a sense of involvement, where there's no juice in it, it's hard to do that kind of work. It's a little bit dry. So why not work where the juice is? Why not work where the feelings have come up? Why do you react a certain way to physical descriptions of yourself, but you don't seem to mind intellectual critique? Isn't that interesting? Does that mean that your mind is safe and your body is not? And you can hear this, where you could go on, I don't know what the situation would be. And that's why when we come down to specifics, sometimes I really bemoan the fact that I cannot be specific in these teleconferences, except when I use myself. But there's a reason for that. The specifics are always unique to the individual, even though there may be a universality to that experience that really touches all of us. But when we talk about the universality, we have a tendency to go into intellect. And that's not effective. And that's also in this lecture. That theory doesn't cut it. That in theory, you can agree with something. But when your emotional reactions show you that you may feel or think something different, that's gold. That's a place for you to work on. Race, gender discrimination, resenting old people versus young people, loving babies and not loving seven-year-olds. Isn't that interesting? What's the difference between a baby and a seven-year-old? Aren't they both people? Well, there's a style and a preference, and there's a personality element, and there's a lot of benign qualities that may mean that you relate better to one age group or one type of person than the other. And if that's all it is, you don't have to worry about it. But for instance, if you're around four different children that all are supposed to have a similar relationship to you, they're all nieces and nephews, they're all grandchildren, they're your children, and you have an extremely strong connection with one, and you feel a distance to another, the question would be why? What's going on there? Because when children especially see that kind of favoritism or prejudice, they take it in and think it's them. Their only frame of reference is it must be me. Uncle Bob doesn't like girls. Granny likes babies. I'll behave like a baby. That's what's going to happen to children. So I think what I'm building here is if you're looking for some place to work, look for discrepancies. Look for places that don't make any sense, even if intellectually you feel that you are clear about something. Notice how your behavior does not match. And when you look at discrepancy and you find the place in the middle, that's a place where you may find that you don't feel as comfortable around teenagers, for instance, because you feel judged by teenagers, but you feel very comfortable around a small child that has not quite got a grasp of what should and shouldn't be and doesn't have their own value system yet. Again, that could be a place of that's quite benign. But it could also mean that if you're favoring one child over the other, you're doing it for self reasons. And that what's actually going on is selfishness. And what this lecture talks about is when we cloak selfishness and call it personal privilege and that's just the way I am and that doesn't mean anything, we're not learning about our own selfishness. We're hiding. It's not that you're bad. It's not that you're wrong. But this could be a place for you to work. And if you don't bother to see it, and you don't bother to work there, then it won't get addressed. And as a general rule, where you don't work, just get, and if there's a negativity there, where you don't work, get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger over time. And in the lecture, The Spiritual Meaning of Crisis, there's a description of that, was if you can't deal with the small stuff, it'll get bigger, don't worry about it. Because, fundamentally, this is about spirituality. It's not about tit for tat, and it's not about how you should or should not behave. So ultimately in the lectures, what I like to remind people is that we've got to go back before our human personality and our situation. We need to go back to the fact that we came in to learn something. We came in to learn many things, but there's probably a core lesson that we are most interested in getting. And that we have developed our family, and I went through the Childhood Hurts lecture a while back, so that you choose your parents and you choose your life situation and your culture and your time period, your epoch and your genes and your hair and your height, because it's going to accelerate the process of learning about something. And that's what the guide referenced when he said that what psychology doesn't get is that mental illness and neurosis and the pain that people feel emotionally and mentally is not about the thing that they feel distress about. That it ultimately comes from a spiritual conflict within them. A sense that you have not done what you're able to do. Now, when I say that, you haven't done what you're able to do, this is where we get back to perfectionism. If I'm able to do it, then I should have done it. Who made those rules? We make those rules. And we make those rules to some degree so that we don't have to develop. What we do with perfectionism is we make the task so impossible that we either are totally consumed by the task, which means we're easily able to forget other things that need to be taken care of, or we make it so impossible that we walk away saying, I can't do that. I can't be that perfect. I can't be that good. I watched the documentary on Mother Teresa, and I was deeply touched by the documentary because Mother Teresa doesn't think she's a saint. Didn't think she was a saint. Mother Teresa had a tough time with poverty and dirt. But she had a mission, she had an idea, she had a goal, and she was going to enact it. Her sainthood, I'm interpreting here, the sainthood is not about not being able to see something. Sainthood is not about not having feelings about something. Sainthood is about moving forward anyway. Through the most insane difficulties, doing something that to the rest of us is absolutely unheard of and impossible. So, in perfectionism, we're setting up a straw picture of too perfect, can't do it. Instead of saying, okay, that's a goal. I'd like to get there. Might not get there during this lifetime. Okay, I'm going to have to accept that. I'm going to start. Another example that I use is if you want to move a mountain of gravel from one place to another place, you can get a truck, and you can get pitchforks, and you can get shovels. Okay? You can also take that mountain of gravel one stone at a time and move it to the other location. Yeah, but that will take a long time. So, it'll get moved. And there is some quality about moving the mountain one stone at a time that is extraordinarily admirable. And getting all excited and rounding up the trucks and getting the volunteers and the bucket brigade and making a drama out of it may also move the mountain. But there isn't necessarily a value judgment on a spiritual level between the two methods. So if you're a rabble-rousing volunteer, organizer, leader, charismatic, that can magnetize people to move that mountain, great. Move the mountain that way. And don't disparage the idea that one stone at a time may also work, but you may have to give up a quality of time, a quality of in this lifetime, and perhaps even a quality of feeling admired and respected by other people. That when they see you moving one stone at a time, they may not think much of you, even if you accomplish the task. They just aren't quite able to get juiced up about it. So I'm digressing again. But I find the lecture allows that. I find it a wide open lecture that addresses many, many different aspects of spirituality and many, many aspects of personality. And that's why I picked it, even though it doesn't have a glorious title and it may not lend itself too much to... Well, anyway, that's why I picked it.
Jen?
Yes?
When you mentioned Emmanuel, are you talking about, like, Emmanuel's? I did a quick search on Amazon, and there's a lot of stuff with the name Emmanuel. So is that Emmanuel's book?
Yes.
By Judith Stanton and Pat Rodegast?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's the one. Yeah, there's a singer called Emmanuel. There's so many things with Emmanuel in there.
Because it comes from the Bible and because it's involved with a lot of biblical stuff, it's a common name. And I thought it would have been easy for me to say Emmanuel.
Okay.
And to my knowledge, there are three books only on the market, and I think it was her son who did the illustrations, which are also delightful.
Well, and it helps. The book is actually called Emmanuel's Book.
Mm-hmm. But there is book one.
Because there were so many. Yeah, there's like book one, book two, and book three.
Right. That's it. That's all there is.
Yeah. Okay. But it's just that Emmanuel is a common name, so there were so many other Emmanuel things that popped up.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So are there any other questions, or perhaps we're done for the day? Going once. Going twice.
I have to laugh, Jen. Earlier when you asked for questions, I started speaking, and it took me a while to realize that I'm on mute.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
So I had a question, but I think you answered it but it was a little earlier in the talk, but I want to mention it. When the restitution when the expression after a hurt is, I'm sorry, I made a mistake,
mm-hmm.
and that's all there is to it,
mm-hmm.
What I get from the depth and the detail that you went to, that's not a restitution, or at least not a complete one. Is that, that's how you see it?
Always understanding that in a given situation, that could be huge. So let me flesh that out a bit. For a person who has never in their lifetime apologized for anything, that could be the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who says that 20 times a day, it's loose change. So you know this because Leah is a helper, works in Northern California with the Patrick of California, that it is so, that every situation is so unique to the circumstances that we don't want to ever say that won't work or can't work. And saying I'm sorry may be the icebreaker that allows a conversation to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So I know personally how very painful it is to try to say you're sorry because you think somebody's going to take the opportunity at that point to say, and you should be. But if you don't start the conversation, you know, how do you really do restitution? Sometimes, well, here's an example. I can understand a situation where restitution would be that you have hurt someone and they are dying to let you know how badly. And you know it's coming. And you know that at the slightest opportunity, they are going to give you what for. That's a Southern expression, what for. Restitution could be opening your mouth, giving them the opportunity, and shutting up as they vent. But that person may find that venting, if and only if it doesn't generate anger in you so that it becomes a tennis match of anger. But giving someone the opportunity to vent their anger, they're probably going to vent more than the situation called for. But that can be a gift that you give someone. So in that situation, saying I'm sorry would depend upon what happened next as to whether it was real and worthy and what else needed to be done. Anyone else? Or if you had more on that, Lance?
I could, but no, I hear what you're saying. It depends on the situation, and what I get from what you're saying is that also there's a place of feeling into the field, whether it's an open field to express more, then that could be enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if the field is closed, and if that was sort of sealing the deal type of a thing, then it's maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's actually avoiding what else may be there that may be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jen, maybe I'm completely off, but I think sometimes the other person can be your clue to whether or not you have achieved restitution. So basically, if the relationship moves to a higher level,
mm-hmm.
in spite of what happened, then really you have created something else with the fabric, the torn fabric that was created there.
Yeah.
And so the other person can be your guide, because if you've done whatever you think was enough, but the other person is still, you know, not the same around you, and it still feels hurt and mentions that again, you know, usually people, when they're still hurt, they mention the incident again here and there, then you haven't achieved restitution yet.
And part of your restitution may be never achieving restitution.
That's right. Like, maybe that person will never trust you again, and that's paying the price as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, acknowledging that, yes, you know, you will never trust me again, and I own it. Because sometimes people tend to deny. You know, they say, well, you know, don't trust me again. You're just exaggerating it. You're such a drama queen, and it's so disproportionate to what I've done. So you question the other person's reality.
Yeah.
Dan?
You know, all of this, I there are so many quotes in the lectures, I start highlighting them, and finally you wind up with yellow pages, because they're all highlighted.
I do that, too.
Yeah. There's a place in the lecture where the guide says, this is an intuitive process. Okay, this is not something that you can learn by rote. And this is where, when you say, I guess saying I'm sorry isn't enough, that depends. It's energetic.
Mm-hmm.
So intuitively, saying I'm sorry may be a necessary first step, and nothing else is going to happen until you say that. But that's not enough. That's not going to finish it off. And sometimes what happens is, because we know that saying I'm sorry is only going to lead to something that we don't want to participate in, that can be a reason to not say I'm sorry. Not because you're not sorry, but you don't want to be penalized for what you've done. You have imagined three other steps that you don't want to take, and this person may invite you to do it. And then when you say no, now you look even worse. So
yeah, that happens a lot. Like, that happens in medical cases where, you know, for fear of liability, the doctors won't even say they're sorry for what happened.
Right. And that alone, and this is a big, it is and was a huge issue in Australia, because the Aborigines were asking, like American Indians did, for somebody to confess and to say, we did wrong, and it was wrong, and we're sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The government literally said, we can't say that because our lawyers say we could get in trouble. That's what they said. And then they elected a new Prime Minister of Australia, and he said, I'm sorry. And to some people, that was not enough. To some people, there will never be restitution. Their list just gets longer. But to a lot of people, what they accepted was, 100 years after the fact, 50 years after the fact, that may be all we can get. You cannot make us whole. But you can remove that insidious quality of moral authority. And with that, we will try to work something out together. So if I go back to, is saying sorry enough? In that case, there was a nationwide celebration over the willingness of the government to say those words. It was huge. And again, for some people, it's not enough. But you do what you can.
And John?
Mm-hmm?
Is there a restitution when both, I mean, agree on that, or is just then, as soon as you feel well, is that okay, or it should be in both sides?
Again, if you're asking specifics, you're probably thinking of a particular situation, And the energy of that situation needs to be honored. For me to answer a question generically does not honor the reality of what happened. Now, I know that's frustrating, and for years I have wanted answers, and Papert doesn't give them very often. What is available in this lecture are suggestions for what you might think about as you puzzle through this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
In other words, what if you and only you could make the right decision, and any act of palming it off to somebody else saying, what do you think I should do, actually diminishes the opportunity for you to look at this situation more creatively and differently. So in not answering the question, I not only want to honor the actual situation, but I want to honor the fact that it's on your plate, not on mine. And something that's on your plate is on there because there's some glitch or stagnation of energy, or there's something that puts it on your plate. Does that make sense? In other words, for you to ask the question means it matters. Okay? And you may not be able to verbalize to me the actual energy and details. So I could give you, I could miss the mark. Assuming I was good enough to hit the mark, I could still miss it by not having the information. But you have that information. And I would like to honor the fact that you have something that you may be puzzling with, that it could allow you to see things in a deeper, more loving way. That make a little bit of sense to your question?
Yeah.
And it's useful to work it out with people. That's what groups are for. That's what friends are for. That's what family can be for. Sometimes it takes hours to noodle out what a situation is about. We're not meant to do this work alone. We're not solitary creatures. And that can be something that you can bring to a small group of people that work together. In 108, at the end of 108, the guide talks about groups. And there's some interesting suggestions. Once again, in the lecture just before this, 108, there's some interesting suggestions for what would make a group alive. And one of the things the guide says is that if everybody put forward what they don't know, the group will become lively. That there are two things that deaden a group. One is not putting forward, and the other is to put forward in a boisterous way that is more about power and trying to feel important or gain acceptance. Neither one of those is real. So the guide gives this key. He didn't use the word key, but let's use it. The way to make a group lively, to really move energy in a group, offer what you don't know. It's possible no one knows, and they're fascinated by the exploration. It's also possible that what you don't know or understand, someone else does. And then what they don't know or understand, you have some insight to offer. So it allows you to be, in the guide's words, it allows you to be both teacher and student to each other. And that's what friendship, in its ideal state, ought to be. A place where you can both learn and teach, where you can offer your strengths and also offer your weakness and be accepted by the other person, supported by the other person, and appreciated by the other person for what you have to offer. It's a beautiful idea. So, we done? I think we are. So I thank you very much for joining me. Very much appreciate your participation. Very much appreciate your comments and questions. And I hope you'll join me in 2 weeks' time. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much,
Jan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.